We're continuing our study this morning on the shadow of good things to come. And we began this part of our study last week when we talked about a subject that's hard for some people to grasp about the Bible. And it's something called types. And in the English, that's spelled T-Y-P-E-S, types. And we have that word in our English language, though we don't necessarily use it in the way we do biblically. In our language, the word type means a kind or a class of something. And that even gives us a clue to the biblical meaning. We also use the word type in the sense of a verb when someone, at least in the old days, sat down at a typewriter, and as they struck those keys, the appropriate lever went up with a letter on the end of it and hit the piece of paper through a ribbon and left a mark or an image. Well, again, that gives us a clue to the way the Bible uses this word type. Without reviewing all of that this week, a type, according to the Bible, is an image or an object lesson that God put in history, in biblical history, in order to foreshadow or prefigure a future spiritual reality. Now, that sounds complicated, but what it means is that God was active through history, Old Testament and New. And some of the things, some of the people, some of the institutions, some of the practices we read about in the Old Testament were purposely put there by God for the specific purpose of pointing to or providing an image in history that came long before another reality in the future that was just like it. Now, why that's hard for us sometimes to grasp is because we don't find that anywhere else except in the Bible. I mean, you would think I was truly strange if I said to you today that Abraham Lincoln was a type of George Bush. Or if I said that, Thomas Edison was a type of Wernher von Braun. People would not even have a clue what we were talking about if we said that. Even though my intent would be to try to say that this earlier person in history was like, in some very significant way, this later person. But more than that, I would say that that likeness was intentional. See, that's the key part of it, is that this likeness between the Old Testament person, event, practice, or whatever it may be, was intentional by God to prefigure this New Testament. And the part we're looking at right now are people who were that way. Last week we looked at two, that the Bible clearly says that God, as they appeared in history, God made them to be like Jesus in some significant way. Adam and Melchizedek. But now by saying they were like him in some significant way does not rule out the fact that they might also be like him in some other less significant ways. But it also means they will be different than him in many ways. You know, you would just think for a moment about Adam. Adam was married, had the first marriage. Jesus was never married. Adam had children. Jesus never had children in spite of the Da Vinci Code. Adam died. So did Jesus. Adam stayed dead. Jesus didn't. See, they're different in some significant ways. Adam was a farmer. Jesus was a carpenter. All sorts of differences. It doesn't require that the person or the event back in the Old Testament be like whatever its prefigures in the New Testament in every way, just in some significant spiritual way. And for Adam, that significant spiritual way was that he was the first man and was called Son of God. And Jesus was the first of a new kind of man and was the Son of God. Melchizedek was both a king and a priest of God that God appointed to that task. He didn't become a priest by having his father or his ancestor be Aaron or Levi. He was appointed to that apparently by God. The same is true of Jesus. But there's all sorts of differences as well. Today we want to look at two more in the Bible that are identified in the Bible itself as types of Christ. And the first of those is one we know very well, and that is Moses. Moses. And what's interesting to me about Moses is that Moses himself said that he was a type of someone else to come. God gave Moses the knowledge before the person he was like ever came, to know that someone else was going to come like him. In fact, that's the words he used in Deuteronomy chapter 18. As Moses is giving his last great speech to the people, at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, he will die. This book of Deuteronomy is basically a series of speeches he gives over several days to the people in preparation for the change in leadership that is coming. When he dies, Joshua will become their next leader. But as he talks to them, he says in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 15, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me." See, he's already predicting someone else is coming. And he's telling us, as we know about types, that it's God who's going to do it. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own brothers. You must listen to him." And then he goes on to actually tell what God said to him down in verse 17 and 18. "The Lord said to me, 'What they say is good, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him.'" So Moses is foretelling someone else going to come like him. And in the New Testament, then, we find that that one is Jesus. For example, we hear Jesus himself saying, I just refer to this in passing, Jesus said to the Jews of his day, "Moses spoke about me." The only prophecy we have of Moses, of the coming Messiah, is the one we've just read. Of all the many things Moses said, and we've got Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy that were all chronicle his life and his messages, the only time we read of where he ever in just so many words spoke of someone else to come is that one we just read. And Jesus said to the people of his day, "Moses spoke about me." And so then in the book of Acts, as the church begins in Acts chapter 2, Peter and the other apostles stand up on the day of Pentecost and preach the message about Jesus for the first time. 3,000 respond to their message. The church begins as those people are baptized and then devote themselves to the apostles' teaching. One day, as Peter and John then are going up to the temple in Jerusalem, at the time of prayer, they're going there apparently to meet with other Christians who are already at the temple, and they're going to have a prayer meeting. They were already used to doing this as Jews, but now it takes on much greater significance because they're also Christians. Or they weren't calling themselves Christians yet. They were just calling themselves disciples of Jesus. But as they go up there, a man asks them for some help. He's disabled. He depends on the goodwill of other people and their kindness in order to get a little bit of money to take care of himself. And that's when he's told by Peter in Acts 3 and verse 6, "Silver and gold I do not have, but what I have I give you. In the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, walk." And taking him by the right hand, he helped him up. And instantly the man's feet and ankles became strong, and he jumped to his feet and began to walk. Well, when this miracle is done right there, as all these people are coming up to the temple, thousands of people coming up there, a crowd immediately gathers because they've probably seen this man there by the entrance to the temple for years, if not decades, begging. And now suddenly here's the same man jumping around and shouting and telling everybody that will listen and even those that won't that these men here in the name of Jesus have just healed him. And that gives Peter and John the audience in order to tell people why this happened. And so they start talking to them about Jesus, that it wasn't by their power that they had made this man whole, but rather by the power that Jesus had. And Jesus was still pretty fresh on everybody's mind because it's been less than 2 months since Jesus had been crucified right there in town and then raised from the dead 3 days later. And so everybody knows who Jesus is when they say that. And Peter even tells them that they had killed the one that God had sent to them, that the prophets had foretold. And so in Acts 3:17, "Now, brothers, I know that you acted in ignorance, as did your leaders. But this is how God fulfilled what he had foretold through all the prophets, saying that his Christ would suffer." And then skipping down to verse 22, "For Moses said, The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among your own people. You must listen to everything he tells you. Anyone who does not listen to him will be completely cut off from among his people. Indeed, all the prophets, from Samuel on, as many as have spoken, have foretold these days. So Peter is saying, the person Moses was talking about, and the person all the prophets were talking about, was Jesus. But he particularly singled out that prophecy by Moses. And again, lets us know that Moses himself was a type of Jesus. He was an image that God struck in history, a person God put in history who was unusual in some one or more particular ways that then became like Jesus because of that. And what was that likeness? Well, Moses himself said what it was. Moses actually said two things, or two parts of one thing. He said, a prophet like me. Now, we tend to still mistakenly think that prophet just means someone who foretells the future. The truth of the matter is, Moses practically never did that. Because the primary meaning of the word prophet in the Bible was not a foreteller of the future, but a forth-teller of God's will. A spokesman for God. A person who would tell people what God wanted them to know. As we read back there in Deuteronomy 18:18, Moses said of this person who was to come, that he will tell the people everything the Lord commands him. Now, isn't that what Moses did to the people of his day? He went up on the mountain, he got the Ten Commandments. He went up on the mountain and he got all the other law. And he came down and he delivered it all to the people. He told the people everything the Lord commanded him. Moses says that this person who's going to come is also going to be a spokesman for God, a prophet. And he will tell the people everything the Lord commands him. And so this is the primary way in which Moses is a type of Christ. They both were spokesmen for God. Now, in the process of that, it has dawned on me there were some other likenesses between them. And I, far from me to say that these were only accidental. I believe many of them were purposeful by God in Moses' life because it gave more credence, if you will, to him being a foreshadowing of Christ who was going to come. Listen to some of the ones I've thought of, and maybe you even think of some more. First of all, concerning Moses, he had a miraculous birth and deliverance. Now, his birth itself wasn't a miracle, as far as we know, but rather when he was born, his mother then had to hide him, and then finally was even put into a reed or woven ark or little boat and set afloat in the River Nile in order to save his life when an evil king was having all the male children killed. Does that sound familiar? Jesus is born in Bethlehem, and soon King Herod is sending out his soldiers to kill every male child aged 2 and under in the city, trying to kill Jesus. So there's a similarity. That wasn't how Moses was a type of Christ, but there's definitely a similarity there. Moses, after he grows up, lives in the palace, turns out, of the Pharaoh himself, the very one who had tried to kill him when he was an infant. Eventually leaves Egypt and goes and spends 40 years living in Midian in a place they call the wilderness. Then one day God appears to him and sends him back to Egypt. And so Moses, in effect, just sort of appears out of nowhere, so it would seem, back to deliver the people. And so it was with Jesus, in a sense. He lived in relative obscurity, grew up in Nazareth, son of a carpenter, the oldest of the children in a large family. But suddenly at age 30, here he is. He appears for John to baptize him, and his ministry begins. Didn't have all that formal training most rabbis did in that time, and all of the special attention that went along with that as they prepared those men, those rabbis, to assume their role in the religious life of Israel. But he just appears out of nowhere, and yet he confounds teachers and people alike by his teaching. A similarity between them. Moses heard God's voice at the burning bush. Jesus heard God's voice at his baptism. Both of them were the points at which they were commissioned to begin their ministry. Moses is described in the Scriptures in Numbers chapter 12, verse 1 and following as the meekest man in all the earth. That's not normally a characteristic you attribute to a great leader. Most great leaders are the so-called type A personalities, gung-ho, get it done, run over everybody that gets in their way. It's my way or the highway kind of people. But Moses was not like that at all. He was always willing to let others go first. He always was thinking of others, not himself. He always, in some ways, thought of himself inadequate to the task, except for the fact that God said he was the one that God wanted to do it. The meekest man in all the earth. Jesus described himself when he said, "Come to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest to your souls." Meekness, an outstanding characteristic of Moses and of Jesus. Ultimately, Moses had to do miracles in order to try to convince both the people and Pharaoh that he was from God. What was the outstanding characteristic of Jesus' ministry to show that he was from God? Miracles. Now, they were a very different kind. Jesus' miracles almost entirely were miracles of healing and of blessing. Moses' miracles turned out to be the plagues on Egypt after the first initial ones of turning a rod into a serpent and things like that. But nevertheless, God gave through them the power to do miracles. Ultimately, Moses delivered the people of God from death to life as they passed through the Red Sea. Jesus delivered his people from death by going into death and back out again in resurrection. Moses was a prophet. Jesus was a prophet. Moses was a priest. We don't hardly ever think about that part of him. But he was from the tribe of Levi, and his brother Aaron was the first high priest. That meant Moses was qualified to be a priest as well. Had that position that allowed him both as prophet and as priest to actually go to God for the people and to go to the people for God. So did Jesus. We've already seen in Melchizedek, Jesus is compared to Melchizedek because he was a priest. It says in Hebrews chapter 3 that Moses was faithful in everything in God's house. The same is true of Jesus. The same Hebrews in chapter 5 will say that about Jesus. Moses in 3, Jesus in 5. When Moses met with God on the mountain, he was transfigured. He was changed. The Scriptures tell us, both in the Old Testament and refers to it again in 2 Corinthians 3, in the New, that when Moses came down off the mountain after having met with God, just being in the very presence and glory of God, somehow his very flesh radiated or glowed. He didn't look like normal people. He glowed in the dark. But gradually Moses noticed that the glow got less and less. And so he wore a veil to hide that gradual change that took place. But what happened when Jesus was up on the Mount of Transfiguration? It says he also was transfigured. He was changed in his very appearance. We might note that when Jesus was up on the Mount of Transfiguration, he was meeting with Moses. It's almost as if, in a way, Moses is passing the mantle, as we talked about this morning in the Bible class, on to Jesus. Recognizing who Jesus was, he's now acknowledging him, along with Elijah, the great, often considered the greatest of the prophets, which we're also studying this morning. Moses, I'm just picking out points of similarity, more than incidental, but really may not have a lot to do with the actual way Moses was a type of Christ. Moses fasted 40 days as he was up on the mountain receiving the law. Jesus fasted 40 days as he began his ministry. Moses' death and what happened afterward is actually mysterious. We don't have the exact details of what happened. It just tells us that he went on up the mountain there just outside the promised land by himself. And then it says he died and God buried him. Isn't that an interesting comment? It tells us over in the book of Jude, chapter 1 and verse 9, that the devil showed up after Moses died and wanted to claim the body. And Michael the archangel was there and refused to let him have it. Something somewhat unusual about the death of Moses and afterwards. Well, the death of Jesus and afterwards kind of unusual too, don't you think? Certainly we know what happened. He was crucified on a cross. They took him down and put him in a borrowed tomb. But on the third day, the tomb is empty. And who's there? Angels. Coincidences? No. All a part of how Moses was a type of Christ? Probably not. But there were some very significant ways in which Moses and Jesus were alike. In the New Testament, Jesus and Moses are often compared and contrasted to each other. Because as a type, Moses and Jesus were so much alike in many ways, and yet there were some differences. One of those differences is in the passage Don read for us this morning, there in John chapter 1. As John writes his introduction to his book, before he begins his story of Jesus, he wants people to understand, on the one hand, that Jesus is the one that Moses was talking about. But on the other hand, he wants people to understand that Jesus was different than Moses in some way. For he says, the law came by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ. They were both lawgivers. Moses gave the law on Sinai that is often thought of in terms of the two tablets of stone and the Ten Commandments. Jesus gave us the law that instead of being written on stones, are written on our hearts. And while Moses revealed to the people the sternness and righteousness and judgment of God for those who sin, Jesus also revealed God's love and compassion and mercy. So Moses, a type of Christ. Next to Moses, the person that Jesus is compared to the most out of the Old Testament is David. For David was a type of Christ. David was not the first king over God's people. That honor or claim goes to Saul in the Old Testament. But Saul was unfaithful to God. And so God changed from Saul's lineage, as where the kings would come from, over to David. And that was something that had been predicted long before that time. Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. God had already told Jacob in the book of Genesis that it would be through his son Judah that the scepter, the kingship, would come. But the first king was from Benjamin. But then while Saul was still king, the elderly Samuel the prophet goes and anoints the youngest son of Jesse in the little town of Bethlehem to be the next king. And David goes on to be the greatest king in the eyes of his own people that they ever had. Now there were other kings that were richer, like David's son Solomon, more powerful, had a larger size kingdom than David did, but there were none that were respected as much as David. And the scriptures let us know that David was a type of Christ. God actually told David that. God actually told David that your son, who will come after you, that I will establish his throne forever. Now, first you might think he's just talking about David's son Solomon. But it seems clear from what God says and what David says that they both knew that's not who God was talking about. Now, when we look in the book of Ezekiel, we hear one of numerous places in the Old Testament where God is predicting the coming of someone in the future. And so in Ezekiel 34, and in verse 22, God says, I will save my flock and they will no longer be plundered. I will judge between one sheep and another. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he will tend them. He will tend them and be their shepherd. I, the Lord, will be their God, and my servant David will be prince among them. I, the Lord, have spoken. Now, what's curious about this statement by Ezekiel is that as he speaks this, David has been dead 400 years already. And yet, as Ezekiel looks to the future, God speaking through him says that a time is coming when I will rescue my flock and I will make my servant David their king. Is God going to raise David from the dead? I like what Peter says in Acts chapter 2 when he was preaching that first gospel sermon. He, in Peter's case, Peter actually quotes something David says and said, brethren, David died, and his tomb is still with us today. So what was Peter saying? The same thing I'm asking. Was Peter was in effect asking the people, did God mean that he was going to raise David from the dead? No, that seemed to be obvious. Instead, it meant God was going to bring someone else like David to fulfill these things in. And again, in Ezekiel 37, the same kind of thought appears as it says, Ezekiel 37:24, "My servant David will be king over them, and they will all have one shepherd. They will follow my laws and be careful to keep my decrees." Now, who is this David who's going to be their shepherd? You ever wondered why Jesus said in John chapter 10, "I am the good shepherd"? Where did that come from, Jesus? You're a carpenter. We can understand it if you talk about your yoke being easy, because carpenters made yokes. We can understand it when you say something about taking the beam out of your eye before you try to get this speck of sawdust out of your brother's eye. That would come right out of his background as a carpenter. But what's this business about, "I am the good shepherd"? He's speaking straight from Ezekiel and claiming that he is that one that Ezekiel was talking about. But what Ezekiel said is that "my servant David will be my shepherd." Jesus then is claiming to be that David. That David is the image that God struck in the Old Testament that now Jesus fulfills. How? What was the significant way that Jesus was the antitype of David? What was it about David that was so significant? King that pleased God. Moses, it was prophet who spoke God's word. For David, it was the king over God's people who always held God up and honored him and led the people to do the same. And so David was a type of Christ. But when we get past that one significant thing, we see all these other little things in David's life that was a part of Jesus as well. The fact that David was from the tribe of Judah, a son of Jesse, and that Jesus was from the tribe of Judah and was a direct descendant of David. They weren't just kin in a very indirect way because they were all Jewish. They weren't even kin just because they were all both from the tribe of Judah. They were kin because Jesus was a direct descendant of David. In both of the genealogies we have of Jesus, in Matthew's account and in Luke's account, one through Joseph, Jesus' legal father, if not his biological one, and the other through Jesus' mother, both of them were direct descendants of David. David was from Bethlehem. God changed the course of history to make sure Jesus was born there. When Mary finds out she's expecting a child, she lives up in Galilee, we assume in Nazareth. When she's 3 months pregnant, when she's 6 months pregnant, when she's 7 months pregnant, she's still up there. Somewhere along the way, the emperor of the Roman Empire decided it was time to have everybody counted and accounted for so he could adjust the tax rolls and get some more tax revenue. So he ordered everybody had to go back to their hometown to be registered. And because Mary was engaged to Joseph, and apparently Joseph was from Bethlehem, they had to go back to Bethlehem. We don't know for sure where Mary was from in terms of where she was born, but she had to go with him. And it's while they are there the child is born in Bethlehem. God changes history to make sure he'd be born where the prophet Micah said he would, in the town of David. David was the king by which all other kings were measured. And as we read through the Old Testament, we're doing that now as we're in 1 Kings. Over and over we run across things that indicate that this king is nothing like David. Or in a few cases, we'll eventually get to men like Hezekiah, where it will say of them that he was like his father David. They measured all other kings by David. Not by Saul, not by Solomon, but by David. Jesus is the king now by which all other kings are measured. He is the king of kings. David was described as being a man after God's own heart. That's an Old Testament way of saying that God loved David. At Jesus' baptism, Jesus heard God speak from heaven, and so did John, who was baptizing him. And God said, "This is my son whom I love." Just like God had said of David. David was not only a king, he was also a prophet. That is, he, at times, God used him to speak God's will. Moses was prophet and priest. David was king and prophet. Jesus was prophet, priest, and king. All three. This is one that's kind of interesting to me. It's more than incidental, but is not required to understand how David was a type of Christ. David, because of his nature and his character, drew men to him. Often men who were just ordinary men, even sometimes outcasts of their society. But in David's service, they ended up becoming what? Mighty men. Jesus drew to himself very ordinary, unschooled fishermen, tax collectors, and others. But under Jesus, they became the mightiest men the world's ever known. We call them the apostles, and others like Timothy and Luke as well. And even today, we might note that as men come to follow Jesus, they often become the most significant leaders in our world, even if they never hold a political office. Peter says in Acts chapter 2, as he's talking to the people of his day, he's talking to them about the resurrection of Jesus, and he tells them that David spoke about the Lord wouldn't leave his body in the grave. He would not allow his body to see corruption. But then he challenged the people by saying, was David talking about himself? And then he says, no, his grave is still with us today. There are two places in Jerusalem that are honored as the tomb of David. One is right in the city itself. Most scholars believe it's only a memorial. We don't know how far back in history it even goes. But no one actually believes it's the real tomb of David, even though it's called that. The other one is just outside the city. It's still marked today. And Peter said in his day, his tomb is still with us today. That's his way of saying David's still in his tomb. But Peter could also say, the tomb of Jesus is still with us today too. But it's empty. And we are witnesses of that fact. David was a type of Jesus in being the great king that the people of God needed. Jesus is the spiritual fulfillment and reality of that for God's people today. Now, there's so much more we could say about this. But I just wanted to sort of introduce this whole idea of certain people in the Old Testament being types of Jesus. Next week, we'll start looking at some other things besides people who were types of things to come. But various ones have looked at other people in the Old Testament and thought that they perhaps also were a type of Jesus in some way. Noah, and certainly we can see that, a preacher of righteousness, delivered eight people at least, counting himself, from the destruction that came on the world. Abraham, the father of many nations, a blessing to all. Isaac, who was not only a child of promise, but was that sacrifice that Abraham was going to make to God until he stopped him. Joseph, someone who started out despised and rejected and ended up being the ruler over his brothers. Joshua, whose name literally is the same name that Jesus bore. In Jesus' day, where he was born and grew up, Bethlehem and then Nazareth, people did not call him Jesus. Jesus is a corrupted Greek, then anglicized form of the Hebrew Joshua. That's what people in his day called Jesus. Joshua. Yeshua. So many see in Joshua in the Old Testament a type of Jesus, because he actually carried the people into the promised land and actually gave them rest from their enemies. Jonah spent 3 days and three nights in the belly of a great fish, then was vomited out and went and preached the gospel of his day, to Gentiles, as Jesus also did. And then in the book of Haggai, we have someone called Zerubbabel, which we know very little about, but God said of him that he was God's signet ring, that God was going to put a mark on history with Zerubbabel, leave his mark there with him. And then in the book of Zechariah, another person by the name of Joshua, who was a high priest, and God told that Joshua in the book of Zechariah, Zechariah, you are prophetic of things that are to come. I personally believe that those things to come was Jesus. But we have to leave those for another study. Why all this effort by God? Why change history? Why dip down into history and not only put people in history, but change their lives so that they turn out a certain way? All so that they could in some way be like someone who in the future who was coming. And as it turns out, the same someone. Adam, Jesus. Melchizedek, Jesus. Moses, Jesus. David, Jesus. Because Jesus was the most significant person in all of history. God was trying to prepare not only His own people, but all people to know that He was the one that God wanted all people to come to. And in the light of the ones we've talked about this morning, that Jesus was going to be God's spokesman, delivering to us God's message and will. He was going to be God's priest, the one that can go to God for us and then can come to us from God. And He was going to be God's king, the one who would rule in righteousness.